And what you see here is the Pade summation for the function log of 1 plus z over z. And what you see is that,
okay, so this is the result of summing the Taylor series for the function log of 1 plus z over z. And that Taylor series has a radius of convergence of 1. So in this table here, this and this, I'm inside the radius of convergence, inside the circle at 1 half. Here, I'm right on the edge of the circle where the Taylor series no longer converges. And here, I'm way outside the circle at 2. And you notice that, first of all, that the Pades are clearly converging. That's the first thing. You can just look at the numbers, and it's obvious that they have converged. Okay. But more importantly, you notice here are the nn Pades, and here are the nn plus 1 Pades. Okay? And you notice that the nn Pades are always going monotone downward, and the nn plus 1 Pades are going monotone upward. Okay? And that's very interesting, because if you have a monotone sequence, a bounded monotone sequence, that sequence must converge. Okay? And you have two bounded monotone sequences which bound each other. And the correct answer is trapped in between the two. It rigorously lies below this and above this. Okay, so that gives you not only an approximation to the answer, but it gives you an upper and lower bound on the answer. And that is, in general, a property of the Pade approximants for what is called the Stieltje series. And I'm going to define that for you in just a moment. OK, so let's see. OK, now, the previous series, when it was expanded in a Taylor series, had a finite, non-zero, that is, radius of convergence. But this series is a really interesting series because it has a zero radius of convergence. And this is the series sum of minus 1 to the n times n factorial times x to the n. Okay? And this series, the radius of convergence is 0. And so this is not a Taylor series. This is sum from 0 to infinity. This is not a Taylor series because it doesn't converge. However, it is a Stieltje series. And therefore, it is known rigorously that the Pades converge to the sum of that series. And you can see them converging. Okay? And here, I'm trying it for two different values of x. First, at x equals 1. And second, at x equals 10. Okay, x equals 10. So it means that n factorial here, which is already very big, is multiplied by 10 to the power n. Okay, so the partial sums of the Taylor series are just off scale. They just go wild. But here, when you look at the Pades, you notice, first, here's the nn Pade evaluated at x equals 1. And it is monotone downward. Okay, and you notice by now it's only changing in the fifth decimal place. This is monotone upward. Okay, so this works just beautifully. Same thing here. This is monotone downward and monotone upward. Okay. So we are able to take a series that has a zero radius of convergence, and the Pades for this series converge everywhere in the complex plane except on the negative real axis. So a Taylor series converges in a circle, but a Pade, at least for a Stieltje series, converges in a region of the complex plane that looks like this. Okay? It converges everywhere except on the negative real axis. Quite remarkable. Okay. Now, let's see. Okay. Okay, now, I want to, this is something that I like to explain to my students all the time, because I think this is an advertisement for asymptotics and asymptotic series. This has to do with the gamma function. Now, I assume that you know or have seen the gamma function, gamma of x. A plot of the gamma function looks like this. This is the x-axis. This is gamma of x, 1, 2, 3, 4. Gamma of x is x minus 1 factorial. Okay, so gamma of 1 is 0 factorial, which is 1. So this is 1 over here. Gamma of 2 is 1 factorial, which again is 1. Okay, gamma of 3 is 2 factorial, which is 2 up here. Okay, gamma of 4 is 3 factorial, which is 6, which is up here somewhere. Okay, so the gamma function is rising very rapidly, and you know that n factorial is a very rapidly rising function. Then it has to pass through that point as well. So what happens is the gamma comes down, hits a minimum, and comes back up, and then it blows up at zero. It has a simple pole at zero. And it has poles, in fact, at all of the negative integers as well. So it has a pole at minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, minus 4, and so on. And what it looks like is this. It comes up, and then it blows up again at minus 1, and then it comes down and blows up again at minus 2 and comes up like this. And it, okay, so the gamma function is analytic everywhere in the complex plane, except that it has poles at 0 and at the negative integers. Okay, so in the complex plane, the gamma function has poles over here. Everywhere else, the gamma function is analytic. Okay, and one other fact, the gamma function is never zero. Okay, so therefore, if you wanted to try to, if you were naive and you wanted to evaluate the gamma function, what you might think of doing is this. You might say, ah, since the gamma function is never zero, why don't we, instead of trying to calculate the gamma function, we will calculate 1 over the gamma function. So 1 over gamma of x is an entire function. Entire means analytic everywhere. That is, any Taylor series of the gamma function about the origin or at any other finite point in the plane converges everywhere. The radius of convergence is infinite. So if I expand this in a Taylor series of the form a sub n x to the n, this Taylor series will converge for all x, just like the Taylor series for the function e to the x. Okay? And there are two problems. So you think, what, you know, there couldn't possibly be a better way to calculate the gamma function than to use a Taylor series whose radius of convergence is infinite. This Taylor series must converge like a shot. Okay? But in fact, there are two problems. The first problem is a technical problem, and that is calculating the coefficients in this. By the way, what is the coefficient for, what is the zeroth coefficient, a sub 0, in this Taylor series? Say it again? 0. OK. You were listening. Good. Because remember, I told you that the gamma function blows up at 0. Therefore, the coefficient of the zeroth term must be 0. Okay, so this is really a sum from n equals 1. The problem is that calculating these coefficients and calculating them with a lot of numerical accuracy is extremely difficult. For example, the coefficients are zeta functions, and the earliest coefficient here is Euler's constant, gamma, okay, which is in fact very, very, very difficult to calculate numerically. Gamma is minus the derivative of the gamma function at the point 1, okay? And it is not even known, by the way, whether this is a rational number. This is an unsolved problem. And if I said to you, calculate gamma to say 16 decimal places, you'd find that an extraordinarily difficult task. If I said calculate e or pi to 16 decimal places, that's trivial. Okay, but calculating gamma is a numerical procedure that is extraordinarily difficult, and it's very hard to find these coefficients. And the coefficients don't have any simple pattern. You know, that the signs of the coefficients seem to be random, plus, plus, minus, plus, minus, 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 plus, minus, that kind of thing. So it's really strange. Furthermore, if you plug in a number, say x equals 1 or x equals 2, and you try to sum the series, you have to sum hundreds and hundreds of terms before you even get 2 or 3 decimal places of accuracy. The Taylor series takes forever to converge. Okay. However, if instead of expanding the gamma function in a Taylor series, if instead of doing that, you decide to expand it in a divergent series, and the name of that series is what? What is the asymptotic approximation to the gamma function called? Do you know? Stirling series, that's right. And the Stirling series for the gamma function looks like this. It goes like x to the x, and then the square root of 2 pi over x, and then e to the minus x. And then there is this asymptotic series that looks like this, 1 plus 1 over 12x plus 1 over 288x squared. And then the terms get more and more complicated. And the sign pattern of these terms is quite interesting. It goes, apart from the 1, it goes plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, and so on. It has that structure. Okay, this is a divergent series. You might not realize that it's divergent because, look, 1 over 288 is much smaller than 1 over 12. Okay, so you might at first think naively that this series is a convergent series, but it isn't. This is a rapidly divergent series. Okay, so it has a zero radius of convergence. However, if you simply plug into this series, plug in x equals 1, or x equals, you know, even smaller than 1, although this asymptotic series is only asymptotic and the limit is x goes to plus infinity, this series can be used to calculate the gamma function with fantastic accuracy. It's a matter of the tortoise and the hare. The Taylor series always wins in the end, okay, because it gets there. Okay, and you can use this Taylor series, at least in principle, to calculate the gamma function with arbitrary accuracy. But in reality, it's hopeless. This is what to use. Why does the Stirling series converge much, much faster than the Taylor series, which is a divergent series, of course? Why does it approximate the gamma function very rapidly and very well, while the Taylor series takes forever to get to the answer? And the reason, it's very subtle, the reason is it has to do with being nice. Is that a good explanation? Yeah, it sort of has to do with being nice. Okay. You see, this Taylor series converges in a circle. All Taylor series have to converge in a circle. This is a circle about the origin, and here is the origin, okay? And what this Taylor series is required to do is, on the right-hand side, to the right of the origin, it has to approximate a function that is growing extremely rapidly. But on the left side of the origin, it has to represent a function which is going It's completely different behavior, and the Taylor series has to represent both. And that's really, really difficult. That's a struggle for that Taylor series, because it's representing, in effect, two different functions at the same time. But the asymptotic series doesn't converge in a circle. That is, it doesn't converge is not the right answer. But it is not asymptotic in a circle. It is asymptotic in this region here. That's the region in which it's asymptotic. That is, it is asymptotic as x goes to infinity with the argument of x, less than pi, an absolute value. Okay? So the asymptotic series is not required to say anything about this crazy behavior on the negative real axis. As a result, the asymptotic series likes you more. And it's a much better approximation, and it converges more rapidly. You don't ask as much of an asymptotic approximation as you do of a Taylor approximation. Okay? So, okay, good. So let me explain what I did here. Where's that? Is that pointer around here somewhere? Oh, yeah. Okay. So what I did, I did a whole bunch of different numerical experiments. You can have really a lot of fun with this. But what I did was I took this Taylor series, and instead of trying to add up the Taylor series directly, I first padded this Taylor series. So I constructed a padé. And what I found was very nice. I was able to improve the convergence dramatically for a Taylor series. Now, in fact, this Taylor series, the gamma function is not a Stieltjes function. And there is no proof, I mean, no theoretical proof that the padé has to converge. There's only numerical experiments. Okay, so I have no explanation for why the padé works so well. But it seems to work wonderfully in all sorts of cases where there's no particular, no theoretical reason yet that has been published to explain why it works so well. It just works well. Okay. So here, I'm evaluating these padés. Of course, after calculating the padé, I turned it upside down. Turned the padé upside down because I was trying to calculate not 1 over gamma of x, but gamma of x.
Why is it 1 over x padé?
Oh, because, as I pointed out, the first term in this Taylor series is x. So I factored out an x and padded the rest because I wanted to have a Taylor series that began with a constant. Okay, so I just pulled out a factor of x. And so you notice how rapidly the padé, so I'm trying to calculate gamma of 1 here, which, as I said, is 1. Gamma of 1 is 1. And here, it converges like a shot. Okay, just wonderful convergence. And I don't know why. I have no idea why. It's just a fact. Okay? And here I calculated it 2, and here I calculated it 4. And you can see 6 coming out, 3 factorial is 6 coming out. And you can see those numbers coming out. Here are the nn padés. Here are the n plus 1 padés coming out. But you notice that because this function is not a function of Stieltjes, which I will explain to you shortly, you notice these approximants are not monotone. They are no longer monotone. Okay. No. So you lose that wonderful property. Okay. Okay. So you can see the convergence to 0 factorial. As 1. 2, this is 1, and 6, and so on. Okay, now let's see. Okay. Let's see, now what I did here, let's see, was that the same? Or it didn't. Did it? Okay. So here is the Stirling series, and I also decided I would padé the Stirling series, just for fun. And again, you get fantastic answers, absolutely fantastic answers. But there's no reason why. I've no idea why. Why does it work so well? Pade is just plain magic. And it's waiting for a theorist to come along and really explain what is going on. But it's not known why. It just works so wonderfully. Okay, now is that, I'm not sure if I was going to show you. I think I had, let's see, what did I have? Oh yeah, so this is more on the convergence of the Stirling series, but I won't show you that. Let me, okay. Okay, so here is one last transparency, and I don't want to take the time to go into in detail, but the question is, imagine that you're doing some sort of fancy numerical calculations, and in the process, you have to make many, many calls of a special function. In this case, the special function is a parabolic cylinder function, d nu of x. Okay? The question is, if you have to calculate the parabolic cylinder function once, it doesn't really matter how you calculate it. You know, you can use its Taylor series or whatever. It doesn't matter. But if you're going to call it many, many times, say because you're integrating over it or something, then you need to do it very, very fast, very efficiently, okay, and very accurately. And the correct way to do that is not to use this function, d nu of x, is an entire function. So its Taylor series converges for all x. And a naive numerical analyst would say, well, since its Taylor series converges for all x, all I need to do is take the Taylor series. And whenever I need this function, I just evaluate the Taylor series. Wrong. Can't do it that way. It's terrible. It's unbelievably slow. You need a huge number of terms. And the correct way to evaluate the parabolic cylinder function is, one, rather than expanding it in a convergent Taylor series, you expand it in a divergent asymptotic series. You then pade the asymptotic series. The accuracy is extreme. I mean, you can get hundreds and hundreds of decimal places accuracy in no time by doing that. So this is the lesson to be learned. And I have here some convergence tables, but it's not even worth going through the detail to show it to you. The parabolic cylinder function is an example of an very interesting transcendental function. And here I'm calculating it with extreme accuracy, but more importantly, using essentially no time at all on the computer. So it's very, very efficient. And I think that's all I was going to. I don't think I have any other tables, but let me just check. No. OK, good. OK, so now, I've shown you just some of the numerics, but now I want to summarize some of the theoretical stuff regarding Pade approximants. Okay, and unfortunately, as I've said, there is no comprehensive theory. There just isn't. So it's waiting for mathematical physicists to come along and to figure out what is going on, but let me at least summarize basically what is known. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to define for you is a Stilchie series. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to do is define for you what is meant by a Stilchie's function and a Stilchie's series. Those are two different things, but of course, obviously, they're related. Okay. So a Stilchie's series. Okay. So a Stilchie's series is a series of the following type. It's a sum from n equals 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n, a sub n times x to the n. Okay, so this is a Stilchie's series. And what makes it a Stilchie's series is that a sub n, okay, where a sub n is the nth moment of some weight function w of x, okay, where w of x is greater than or equal to 0. Okay? So, again, if you have a function w of x, which is greater than or equal to 0 for 0 less than or equal to x less than or equal to infinity, okay? So you have, that's called a weight function. And this function is, and of course, all of these moment integrals have to exist. So we are calculating the nth moment of this weight function, okay? And and of course, these numbers, a sub n, are all positive numbers, okay? Then if you take these numbers and you stick them into a series of this type, this series is now called a series of Stieltjes. So there are lots of examples, but a simple example would be the series that I just, or in fact, is it still written? No. So an example would be the sum from 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n, n factorial, x to the n. That's an example of a Stieltjes series. Can you tell me in this case what w is? Say it again?
E to the minus x.
E to the minus x. Okay. And in fact, just so we don't get x's confused, let me change this to t. Okay. Because there's an x in the series, and I don't want the x in the integral confused with the x in the series. So indeed, in this case, w of t is e to the minus t. Okay? So that's an example, a standard example that is used to study a Stieltjes series. Okay, so this is an example of a Stieltjes series. And there are lots and lots of examples of Stieltjes series. A Stieltjes series might be divergent, and it might be convergent, might have a finite radius of convergence, or it might have a zero radius of convergence. And so this is the class of series that we're interested in. Okay. Now, second, a Stieltjes function. Okay, what is a Stieltjes function? A Stieltjes function is what you get if you apply a summation technique to a Stieltjes series. So what do I mean by a summation technique? Well, essentially what we're doing is Borel summation. What we're going to do is we're going to say, take this Stieltjes series and write it this way, sum from n equals 0 to infinity, minus 1 to the n, x to the n, and the formula for a sub n is the integral from 0 to infinity, dt w of t, t to the n. Okay? And now we're going to interchange the orders of integration and summation. Okay, so I'm just going to interchange, and I get the integral from 0 to infinity dt w of t times the sum from n equals 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n, x to the n, t to the n. Okay? And the sum of this series is 1 over 1 plus xt. Okay, so a Stieltjes function, f of x, is, so now, of course, this interchange may have been illegal, but that isn't the point, because I'm simply going to define, definition, a Stieltjes function is a function of this type, which can be written in that form. Okay, so this is a Stieltjes function. So if you ever see a function written in this form, where, and again, where w of t is greater than or equal to 0 for t greater than or equal to 0, and W has to have the property that the nth moment, W of t, t to the n dt, exists, okay? Such a function is called a function of Stieltjes, or a Stieltjes function, okay? So those, and it turns out, it is for these functions that Pade approximants are understood. Okay? Now, if you take a Stieltjes function and you expand it into an asymptotic series, okay, you get this Stieltjes series. So the Stieltjes series is what corresponds to a Stieltjes function. Okay? Now, there is an extremely important properties. Properties of Stieltjes functions. So there are about four important properties of Stieltjes functions. And this is absolutely crucial. Okay. So let me enumerate these properties. First of all, as x goes to infinity, f of x goes to 0. Okay. Now, as x goes to infinity, with goes to infinity in the cut plane. Okay. So as x goes to complex infinity in the cut plane. So what do I mean by that? Here is the complex x plane, and there is a cut over here. Can you tell me why is there a cut over there? Why is that true? Yeah.
Negative, it skews up the way you've written your function.
That's exactly right. If x happens to be a negative number, it's OK if x equals 0. Okay? But if x is negative, real and negative, then this integral ceases to exist. It just does not exist. Okay? So this function is defined, I should make a comment, defined for all x in the cut plane, the complex plane, all complex x, except for negative real x. Okay, so that integral exists. Now, the first fact is that as x runs off to infinity, that direction, or that direction, or that direction, or this direction, any direction, this function goes to 0. And this is true simply because there's an x in the denominator, in the integrand. So the integrand vanishes, and the function goes to, and the integral goes to 0. Okay? The second fact is that f of x is analytic in the cut plane. And the question is, why? First of all, what does analytic mean? What does the word analytic mean?
Infinitely differentiable in the complex.
That's right. So for any point in the complex plane, f of x has a derivative. F of x is an analytic function. Okay. So the question is, how do you show that it's analytic? Yeah. Yeah.
But what happens if you don't converge on with a constant argument? If you go closer and closer to the cut?
Then we don't know. Then as we approach the cut, it's likely to blow up.
Okay.
So we have to stay bounded away from the cut. Okay, strictly bounded away. Okay. So how do we prove that f is analytic in the cut plane? Well, it's easy. All you have to do to show that it has a derivative is to calculate the derivative. It's easy. take the derivative. So what is f prime of x? Take the derivative. We can take the derivative under the integral sign. Why? Because the integral is uniformly convergent. We take the derivative with respect to x, and we get f prime of x is minus the integral from 0 to infinity dt w of t over 1 plus xt squared with a minus sign and some factor of t. OK, so I just took the derivative, and it exists. Now, once you know that a function in the complex plane has one derivative, it automatically means that it has an infinite number of derivatives. Complex variables, the calculus of complex variables, is a wonderful theory. Because, as you know, when you're just dealing with real calculus, it's possible to have a function that has one derivative, but not two derivatives. Or seven derivatives, but not eight derivatives. Okay? But in the theory of complex variables, once a function has one derivative, it has an infinite number of derivatives. Pew, just like that. Okay? Now, this is not a course on complex variables, so I'm just going to state that as a fact. So I've established that it has one derivative, and that's all I need to do. So it has an infinite number of derivatives, so it's analytic. Okay? Only two more properties that I want to establish. The third property is that this asymptotic series this series is an asymptotic representation of that function. This series is asymptotic to this function. As x goes to infinity, with the argument of x in the cut plane. I'm sorry, I just like as x goes to 0, as x goes to 0, with the argument of x in the cut plane. OK? So this series that I wrote down, the Stieltjes series, is actually asymptotic to this function f of x. OK? And there's one last fact, which is really cool. Okay. By the way, the theory of summation relies very heavily on complex variables, as you can now sort of smell. And you will love this last property. The last property is that minus f of x is Perglotz, which is a terrific word. You have to be careful. I mean, if you walk into a bar and you walk up to some guy who's drinking something strong and you say, I think you're Perglotz, you're likely to end up with a bloody nose, of course. I would never say that to a person I didn't know well. But in any case, minus f is Perglotz. And the question is, what does that mean?
Is there okay. An arm there?
Perglotz. There is an R, indeed. So what is so what does this mean? It actually means something very, very simple. It means that the imaginary part, so a function is said to be Perglotz if the imaginary part of that function has the same sign as the imaginary part of x. In other words, in the upper half plane, in the upper half complex plane, the imaginary part of f is positive, of minus f is positive, and in the lower half plane, it's negative. Okay? And the question is, can we show that? And let me just show you why that's true. Okay. So this is really very easy to show. So remember, I just said f of x is equal to the integral from 0 to infinity dt w of t over 1 plus xt. Okay? We start there, because that's the definition. Okay? Now, suppose we're in the complex plane. So that x, let's say, is a plus ib, just for fun. Okay? If x is a plus ib, then let's just put it in. A plus ib. Okay? Then all I need to do is to rationalize this. Okay? Just rationalize it. Let's multiply the bottom and the top by the complex conjugate. Okay? So in the bottom, I put in 1 plus t times a minus ib. Okay? And in the numerator, I put in 1 plus t times a minus ib. That's all. Just multiply top and the bottom by a complex conjugate. All right? And now I ask, what is the imaginary part of f of x? What is that? Well, first of all, let's see what's in the denominator. Okay? When you multiply this out, you're actually multiplying out 1 plus at, okay, plus ibt times 1 plus at minus ibt. When you multiply these together, you get 1 plus at squared plus b squared t squared. And this is strictly positive. It's the sum of two squares. So that's positive. In the numerator, you have a dt w of t. W of t is positive. Okay? And when I take the imaginary part, it just means that I'm picking out the thing that's multiplied by I, which is minus bt. All right? Did you all follow that? Yes? You look okay. So let me, b is just a constant, so I will factor that out. And the minus sign I can factor out. In fact, I'll put it over here on the left-hand side. So you notice that everything inside this integral is positive. T is positive, W is positive, denominator is positive. So this is a positive number. So what that shows is that the imaginary part of minus f has the same sign as b. But b is the imaginary part of x. Okay? So a Herglass function has the property that minus f has the same sign as the imaginary part of x. Okay? So in the upper half plane, minus f is positive. In the lower half plane, minus f is 0. And on the real axis, minus f vanishes. The imaginary part of minus f vanishes. Okay? And when that happens, this function is said to be Herglotz. Okay. Now, these are the four important properties of Stieltjes functions. And now I'm going to drop the bomb, because this is the big deal. Okay? So, if you have a Stieltjes function, it has properties 1, 2, 3, and 4. But the bomb is that if you have a function that has properties 1, 2, 3, and 4, that means that it's a Stieltjes function. Okay, and that is a deep result. Proving these properties is relatively easy. But if you have a function with these four properties, it is a function of Stieltjes. So any function with these four properties is automatically a function of Stieltjes. Stieltjes function here. Okay? And that is the key thing. Okay? And I'm not going to prove it. If you like, I could begin a proof, but I don't know if there's, well, I don't know. How much do you know about complex integration? Do you know complex contour integration? How many of you have not seen complex contour integration? You're afraid to admit it. I know. I'll give you a very quick I, of course, I'm not going to prove this, but I'm going to show you how the proof begins. The proof is many, many, many pages long. But showing you how the proof begins is not so bad, and it goes something like this. Suppose you know that a function is analytic in the cut plane. So it goes like this. We have a function that is analytic in a cut plane, and we wish to count this as the complex t-plane, and we wish to calculate the function at a point x. Can you tell me how to represent a function? So I'm told that this function f of x is f of t is analytic in the complex t-plane. Do you know how to represent the function at this point x? Well, the key word was contour integration. Do you know how to represent this function as an integral? Anybody know how to do that? The Cauchy integral formula. What does it say? Doesn't have to be a circle.
But just any kind of round.
Okay. Okay, good. So what you say is, let's take a contour that encloses the point x. Then what we know from this theorem, the Cauchy integral representation, which is the most powerful, it is the fountainhead of all knowledge of everything in complex variables, is this one theorem. It says that f of x is equal to 1 over 2 pi I times an integral along this contour. Let's call that contour C. Okay? In this direction around the contour, okay, in the positive direction, dt over t minus x, back, x, times f of t. Okay, there is no such integral representation in real variables, only in complex variables. Complex variables is much more powerful than real variables. So if you have a real function of x, there's no such integral representation. Okay, so this is a beautiful result. And now we argue the following. Since this function, I've used the property that f is analytic, but since the function is analytic, I can move the contour around. So I will move the contour around. So instead of going like this, I will push it outward. And of course, the function is not analytic on that cut running along the negative real axis, but I can push the contour out so it goes like this. Okay, this contour is called by people a keyhole contour. I call it a toilet seat contour because I think it more accurately represents a toilet seat than a keyhole, but whatever. And so the contour looks like this. Okay, so we have already used property 2, analyticity. Now I'm going to use property 1. The function vanishes at infinity, so the contribution, if I push this integral off to infinity, the contribution along here vanishes. And I'm left with an integral that goes up the imaginary, up the negative real axis and down the negative real axis and contains the negative real axis in between. Okay. So now what I can do is rewrite this integral. So I have an equation, f of x is equal to 1 over 2 pi I times an integral from minus infinity up to 0. Minus infinity up to 0 of dt over t minus x times f of t plus I epsilon, okay, is here, minus f of t minus I epsilon. Okay, and this is called the discontinuity across the cut. And this discontinuity across the cut is pure imaginary. Why? Why is this pure imaginary? Because, say it again? The Herglotz property, that's right. Okay, so as I get very, very close to the cut, because here I'm in the upper, because, you know, I'm in the upper half plane and here I'm in the lower half plane, so the discontinuity has to be pure imaginary, which is what cancels this factor of I. Okay, so the factor of I cancels, and now I have an integral representation, so all I need to do is to replace t by minus t. Okay, so I in this integral, I replace t by minus t in my integration. Okay, so that gives me a minus t over here, and I'm integrating from infinity down to 0. So I turn that upside down and absorb the minus sign, and that gives me 1 over 2 pi times an integral from 0 to infinity dt over minus t minus x times times this discontinuity. Okay, and I'm just going to call this discontinuity of t. And in fact, this discontinuity is negative because you remember I said minus f is Herglotz. Minus f is Herglotz. So that absorbs this minus sign. And I'm so the discontinuity itself is pure imaginary, and I have absorbed that factor of I into this discontinuity. Okay? And now, if I make a change of variable, t goes into 1 over t. That's the final step here. If I replace t by 1 over t, now I still have an integral okay, so I've replaced the integral dt, replaced t in the integral by 1 over t. I better write that down. Replace t by 1 over t. This is the integral that I get, okay? And now I take one factor of t and put it under the discontinuity. And I take the other factor of t here and multiply through, and I get 1 plus xt. And you notice this is the form, can you see that? Oh, I'll lift this. Okay, so this is exactly the form of a Stilche series that I wrote down. It's dt times w of t over 1 plus xt, and now you know what w is. That function w here, in that little derivation I gave you, is d of 1 over t divided by t. That is the function w. Are we done? You notice I, by simple changes of variable, I made this function look exactly like a Stilche's function. But I'm not done yet. Why not? I have to show that w is positive, and that comes from the Herglotz property. Okay? But I have to show that all the moments exist. And I haven't shown that yet. And that comes from the fact that so I've used Herglotz, I've used all these properties, but I have not used this asymptotic property. Okay? And from this asymptotic property, I have to deduce that all the moments of this thing here, this function, are positive. Okay, that's not easy. Okay. And so I'm not going to show it to you, but you can read, if you're interested, you can go to the literature and read about it. Yeah. No, it is fundamental, and now I'm going to show you why. Okay, so, and now this whole, what I've been talking about is going to come together. What I've been talking about for the last 2 weeks. So, the Herglotz property is fundamentally connected with the Schrodinger equation. And And that's the reason why this is so interesting. Okay? So suppose we go back to this perturbative, this very interesting perturbative model. So your Hamiltonian, let's say, is p squared over 2 plus v of x, which is some Hamiltonian that you can solve. You can call this h naught or something. This is some solvable Hamiltonian. And now you complicate the potential by adding on another function w of x, okay, which makes the Schrodinger equation not solvable. So we're going to insert a perturbation parameter epsilon, okay? But we have, so what is the Schrodinger equation, h psi equals e psi, the time-independent Schrodinger equation, say? It says minus d squared dx squared, minus 1 half d squared dx squared, plus v of x, plus epsilon w of x, times psi of x, is equal to e times psi of x. Okay? That's the Schrodinger equation. This is what defines the energy levels. This is the key equation that you solve in a modern physics problem. That's it. This is the thing that you want to solve. Okay? Now, what should we do with this equation? It's very simple. Let's multiply both sides of this equation by psi star of x. Okay? So the first term, the left side contains now a psi star. The right side contains a psi star. Okay? And now let's integrate this from minus infinity to infinity with respect to x. This is a standard procedure that you always do with the Schrodinger equation. You've done this in class many, many times. Okay? So on the right-hand side, you have e times the integral from minus infinity to infinity dx psi star times psi. Okay? And on the left-hand side, let's look at all the terms that you get. There are three separate terms. Okay? The first term is psi star times the second derivative of psi. And you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to integrate once by parts, and I'm going to get a minus sign. So that gives me plus the integral from minus infinity to infinity with a factor of a half dx psi star prime of x times psi prime of x. And by the way, in that integration by parts, I've used the fact that the eigenfunction vanishes at infinity. Okay, so I've thrown away the boundary term. Is that all clear? And then the next term is an integral from minus infinity to infinity v of x times psi star times psi. That's the v term. And then there's an integral from minus infinity to infinity times epsilon times psi star times psi times w of x. Okay? All right, now you know what I'm going to do next. I'm going to emphasize that this guy here is real and positive. It's certainly real, and it's certainly positive, because it's psi star psi. This, if you imagine w of x to be some function like x to the 4, is real and positive. And this, if you imagine v of x as some function like x squared, okay, is real and positive. And finally, this is real and positive because it's a function multiplied by its complex conjugate. So this is real and positive. So what am I going to do? I have only one step left in this argument. What am I going to do? No, what I'm going to do is, epsilon is in general some complex number. Okay? Epsilon could be complex. Okay? So, but what am I going to do? I'm going to take the imaginary part. OK? If I take the imaginary part, this is real and positive, so it contributes nothing. This is real and positive, so it contributes nothing. Okay? But if I take the imaginary part, I get the imaginary part of epsilon multiplied by the integral from minus infinity to infinity, psi star psi times w of x, which we agree is real and positive. And that's equal to the imaginary part of e times the integral of psi star psi, which again is real and positive. That proves that the sign, that is, the imaginary part of the energy, is positive if the imaginary part of epsilon is positive, and the imaginary part of the energy is negative if the imaginary part of epsilon is negative. Therefore, E of epsilon is Herglotz. And that's amazing. That's really quite amazing. Okay, and that's the reason why the Herglotz property is so important. And it's amazing to me that nobody ever talks about this. And it's very rare. I mean, some people do, but it's very rare. So the key thing about the time-independent Schrödinger equation is that the energy levels in a quantum theory are Herglotz functions of the perturbation parameter. Okay. Now, it is non-trivial, but rigorously true that, so this is a model that we're going to talk about next time. By the way, in the class next time, I'm going to show you that how to calculate for the Hamiltonian p squared over 2 plus x squared over 2 plus epsilon x to the fourth. I'm going to tell you how to calculate the energies perturbatively, E of epsilon, as perturbation series in powers of epsilon. I'm going to show you how to do this using using ordinary quantum mechanics or using Feynman diagrams. I'm going to give you the classic comics explanation of Feynman diagrams. Okay, really simple, because in my opinion, courses on field theory turn Feynman diagrams into very complicated things when they're extraordinarily simple. They just follow from one simple equation. So I'm going to show you where the Feynman diagrams come from. Okay, but when you, so I'm going to derive this series, but this series, this function here, we now know E of epsilon is a Herglotz function. And that's the key thing. This function is Herglotz. You can also prove rigorously that this function is analytic in epsilon. So E of epsilon here is Herglotz. It's analytic in the cut plane. This series is an asymptotic series. These are all general properties. And it's easy to show, it's very easy to show, that E of epsilon over epsilon goes to 0 as epsilon goes to infinity. That's very easy to show. And therefore, so E actually blows up, but E of epsilon over epsilon goes to 0. And that's sufficient for me to conclude that this function here is a function of Stieltjes. And that's the key thing. OK. Now, let me just close by telling you, well, so the last step that we have to talk about is, so what does this have to do with Pade theory? And what Stieltjes showed rigorously is that, so Mr. Stieltjes showed that the following is true. If you construct the Pades for for a Stilche series. If you construct the Pades for a Stilche series, what you can show is that PNN is monotone, first of all, PNN of X converges to a limit, approaches a limit as n goes to infinity. PNN and PN n plus 1 both converge to limits. We could call this limit maybe L1 and this limit L2. As n goes to infinity, in for all x in the cut plane. So you pick a value of x, that guy, okay? If you have a Stilche series and you calculate the Pades, the diagonal Pades, PNN and PNN plus 1, for some value of x in the anywhere in the complex plane, anywhere, the Pades converge to limits. Not necessarily the same limit, but they definitely converge to limits. That's the first fact. The second fact is, for real x, for real positive x, PNN is that sequence, PNN of x, is monotone decreasing, and PNN plus 1 of x is monotone increasing, and that so you can show the following, that here, for example, here's PNN. So if we construct P00, P11, P22, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, all of these guys are, this is a decreasing sequence, and it approaches some limit, L1, let's say. This is for real positive x. Whereas these guys are monotone increasing. So P01 is less than P12, which is less than P23, da-da-da-da, which approaches a limit, L2. Okay, and the actual value of the Stilche's function, f of x, for that value of x, strictly lies between here and here. The problem is, so we know the answer lies between this limit and that limit. The problem is, does this limit equal that limit? Okay? And in general, there isn't an answer to that question, but there is a fifth condition. And the fifth condition, so this is the last bit of the theory, and that will summarize everything that is known. Okay? The last bit of the theory is that if the A sub n, this is like condition five. If there is a unique solution to the moment problem. Okay, so what does that mean? A sub n is equal, remember we said A sub n is equal to the integral of w of x from 0 to infinity, x to the n. It's given by the nth moment of w. If there's a unique solution to the moment problem, so what that means, given all of the A sub n, I can find, this gives a unique moment W of x. There may be several moments, but if there's a unique solution to this moment problem, then L1 equals L2 equals f of x. Okay? And that's the bottom line. Now, how do we know if there's a unique solution to the moment problem? And the answer is, there isn't a complete answer, but I could give you a very nice partial answer. So we have a unique, so this is called the Carloman condition. I love it because the first part is my name, you know, but forget that. Okay, the Carloman condition, so Mr. Carloman was able to show that if a sub n grows no more rapidly, grows as rapidly as or less rapidly than 2, so less rapidly than 2n factorial, there is a unique solution to the moment problem. Okay, so this is a sufficient condition for there to be a unique solution. Nobody knows a necessary condition. Okay, this is a very, very interesting problem. You could spend your life studying moment problems if you wanted. Okay, it's a very, very deep and interesting problem. But a simple, straightforward, sufficient answer is, if the a sub n grow less rapidly than 2n factorial, then there is a unique solution to the moment problem. So, here's the conclusion. Are you listening? You are trying to calculate a function, which in our case is E of epsilon, because we're interested in quantum mechanics. Okay? We're interested in calculating a function. If you can prove five things, one, that the function you're calculating goes to zero as its argument goes to infinity, or actually, that it just grows algebraically. If you could divide it by epsilon and then let epsilon go to infinity and it goes to zero, that's sufficient. Okay. If you can show that this function is analytic in the cut plane, that it's represented by this perturbation series, and that that perturbation series is an asymptotic series, is asymptotic to the function, and that the function you're calculating is Herglotz, and last, that the coefficients of that asymptotic series grow less rapidly than 2n factorial, then when you calculate, even though this perturbation series diverges for all epsilon, it's always divergent, the Pade sequence converges okay, in this beautiful monotone fashion when you're on the real axis, and converges everywhere in the cut plane to the function that you're trying to calculate. That is from top to bottom. That's it. Now, what we don't know yet is whether or not this Carloman bound is actually so, and I'll talk about that next time, because you can see that coming from the Feynman diagrams. Okay, this is easy to see from, not easy, but relatively easy to see from the Feynman diagrams. So what this says is that at least in this part of the world, this is a small part of the possible theory that needs to be worked out for Pade theory. We know rigorously that the Pades converge to the correct answer. Okay? Now, when you're doing a Feynman diagram calculation, do you know, in general, suppose you were working not in quantum mechanics here, but in QCD or in electrodynamics, do you know that the function is a function of Stieltjes? You don't know that. Okay? And it has not been proved. But in quantum mechanics, it is a function of Stieltjes, and that's rigorous. So, in fact, the energy levels of any quantum problem where you're solving the Schrodinger equation for the energy levels, those energy levels as functions of x are functions of Stieltjes. This is really a fantastic result. Okay, and it took many years to establish this fact. Yeah?
When you were talking about the
energy functions of epsilon. You put some conditions on V and W. I thought you were...
Oh, yes, like, over here.
You gave specific forms for V and W.
Yeah, I said for our purposes, we're going to take V to be x squared. You know, this is the harmonic oscillator, and that makes the anharmonic oscillator. But I didn't have to do that. Okay. I mean, W could have been a more general function.
So, like, are there sort of weakest known conditions that you can put on V and W?
Well, for example, I could have taken W to be... So, in our case, these coefficients here, when you have an x to the 4, grow like n factorial. Okay. If this were x to the 6, then these coefficients would grow like 2n factorial. If this were x to the 8, these coefficients would grow like 3n factorial. Uh-oh, we have now violated the Carloman condition. Okay? And if indeed, if you calculate the Padés, what you find is that the nn Padés make a sequence which is going down like this, because we have a Stieltjes function, so it's a monotone sequence. And it converges to a limit, you know, L1. And the p, n plus 1 Padés are converging up here to a limit L2. And the exact answer, as calculated just by solving the eigenvalue problem on a computer, is in here. But we don't, if we didn't know what the answer was, all we know is that the answer lies between here and here. This already gives the answer accurate to about 1%, but that's all you can get. Okay? So, I mean, these are the final, I'll make the comment now, but I'm going to make these comments tomorrow as well. There is a fundamental, I mean, I've given you sort of a summary of what is known about summation theory, but there's lots more to be done. In particular, we have calculated, you know, a perturbation expansion, say, for an x to the a theory. We have calculated all, in principle, all the perturbation coefficients. Those perturbation coefficients, I'm sure, know what the answer is. But if you try to find the answer using Padé theory, you get close to the answer, but you don't know the exact answer. Okay? So this is a problem in information theory. It's like you have a blurred photograph, and you're trying to unblur the photograph. When you take the answer and expand it in an asymptotic series, you are blurring the photograph. And we now need to unblur the photograph and get the exact answer. And some procedure in information theory will work. There is some way that you have to unblur that photograph and extract the answer. Okay, and that is really an open problem. How do you, in general, when you have a series, how do you extract the sum of the series most efficiently? How do you use the smallest number of terms to get the largest amount of information about that series? You know, we know lots of techniques, but this is a very, very, very deep and very interesting mathematical problem, and it's not known what the answer is in at all. So this is a wonderful, wonderful problem. You can see how important it is. Yeah?
At the end, you put a pretty harsh condition that x is real and positive. Yeah. Everything is converging, actually, it'd be monotone, decreasing, and increasing, and so on.
Oh, sure. Because if x were complex, then you can't say, you can't use...
Yeah, like the ordering.
If you have complex numbers, you lose the ordering. Yeah. So only for real numbers is can you...
But in complex numbers, with L1 and L2 be close? I mean, do we have any here?
L1 and L2, what we do know is that the Padés converge to some complex limit, L1.
Is that close?
Oh, yeah, it is pretty close. Although what happens is that as you go around toward the cut on the left-hand side, those L1 and L2 get further and further away from each other, unless you have satisfied the Carloman condition, in which case, even for complex numbers, L1 equals L2. And that equals the limit. So there's no ambiguity if you've satisfied the Carloman condition.
And is there going to be any tricks to recover that half the real axis? Because in general, we might be interested in
x's.
Here, you mean
and we're still
here?
Missing half of the, yes.
Yeah, oh, no. The point is that the function is not unique there.
Yeah.
Because you remember I told you that if you go around in the complex plane far enough, if you go past here, you encounter those square root singularities. Well, and if you go around this way, so the function you're calculating as a function of complex epsilon is not unique here.
You mean within the E of epsilon? Or?
That's right. There are two different answers. Remember I told you that the function was defined on a three-sheeted Riemann surface. Here's the first sheet, and here's the cut. And if you go around past here, you're now on this sheet. You come out over here. And that's where all of those branch cuts are. And if you now go around the other way, you come out over here. OK, you're now over here. And again, there are these cuts, OK? So if you approach the negative real axis in one direction, you get one answer. If you approach the negative real axis in the other direction, you get another answer. So there isn't a unique answer. There are two different answers. That's because this is a multiple-valued function.
But surely I can have a Hamiltonian that will be defined for a negative epsilon.
You can only in the case of a regular perturbation theory. And in that case, things are actually a little bit more complicated. And I'll tell you what happens in that case. It's actually, it turns out that if the function is well-defined on the negative axis, then the Padés have problems converging. Okay, but the perturbation series, and it's hard to prove whether or not the Padés converge. In this case, the Padés are a little bit like the series for the function e to the x, and proving which is not a Stieltjes function, very hard to prove that you have convergence and so on. So I'll tell you about that privately. That's a longer discussion. Okay, the Padés do converge, but it's harder to show. Okay. All right. We'll see you tomorrow. Tomorrow I will sort of give you an explanation of finite divergence and how it all works.